The Clash of the Two Americas, Volume 1, The Unfinished Symphony, was written by Matthew Errett and Cynthia Chung and published by the Canadian Patriot Press. This recording is narrated by Hugh Patrick Trudeau. Chapter 6, Hamilton's Genius and the American System. Today's world calls out desperately for a systemic change. This means not only a change in thinking about diplomacy, the superiority of win-win cooperation over might makes right, but it also means a change in thinking about value itself. Everyone agrees that money is useful, and few people would say that they don't want more money. But is money's value derived from the simple desire people have for it? Is it the willingness of consumers to pay for a thing that gives that thing value? Before answering in the affirmative, think about heroin. Does heroin have value? How about prostitution or gambling? Certainly, all of these things generate trillions of dollars in measurable GDP globally every year. But do they hold actual value, or is it merely ephemeral? Some might say that there is no such thing as intrinsic value, and that all value is ephemeral, based on the fluctuating tastes of the day. But would those people wish to go a week without food or water? Would the 7.8 billion lives on Earth do well if the energy needed to sustain human existence disappeared? Of course not. So why do economists today fail to differentiate between the false value of money associated with activities that are inherently destructive to our nations and our children, from those activities, the actual value of which enhances the lives of our people and nations? Whatever the causes for this intellectual and moral blindness prevalent in academia and public servants alike, the fact is that this deficit exists, and to the degree that we fail to rectify this problem, we as a civilization will be morally unfit to navigate through the oncoming storms set to befall Western civilization amidst an economic meltdown. Some elementary principles of natural law. While this chapter will review some elementary facts of recent history that provide keys to solving these intellectual and moral obstacles, a few general truths are worth enumerating here, upon which the new economic order must be premised. First, a respect for national sovereignty under a win-win system of cooperation and not a system of supranational controls directed by an unelected elite. Second, large-scale, long-term infrastructure projects that raise the standard of living of all people, as well as increasing the cognitive powers of all people and the productive powers of labor of all people simultaneously. Third, that this process has the natural effect of increasing national capital and consumer consumption per capita and per square kilometer, since higher quality lives lived longer equates to higher rates and quality of consumption, both individually and nationally. A viable modern guidebook to explore this system scientifically can be found in the writings of the late American economist Lyndon LaRouche, with a focus upon his 1984 book, So You Wish to Learn All About Economics. Taken together, these three variables would tend towards an increase of humanity's carrying capacity, conditional upon the factor that ivory tower mathematicians and computer models dominant in today's economic and climate science worlds detest, and that would be human creative reason. The opposing school of political economy, premised as it is upon the British imperial theoreticians who have sought to undermine this tradition, is based on the Malthusian assumption that material limits to nature are insurmountable and that population growth will always exceed nature's capacity to sustain ever-growing numbers. See Chapter 11 for more on Malthus. The role of creative thought in economic systems. Abraham Lincoln understood this fact all too well 160 years ago when he said in 1860, "Man is not the only animal who labors, but he is the only one who improves his workmanship. This improvement he effects by discoveries and invention." This idea was amplified by Lincoln's leading economic advisor, Henry C. Carey, who said in his 1872 A Unity of Law, "The more his power of association, the greater is the tendency toward the development of his various faculties, the greater becomes his control of the forces of nature, and the more perfect his own powers to self-direction. Mental force, thus more and more obtaining control over that which is material, the labors of the present over the accumulations of the past." If you haven't noticed it, both Lincoln and Carey recognized that it is by increasing rates of discoveries of hitherto unknown organizing principles of the universe that allows our species to translate those new discoveries into greater rates of scientific and technological progress. This overcoming of our limits to growth by leaping to new technologies and resources would then establish a guiding framework for planning future investments into R&D with a focus on activities that push the frontiers of human knowledge. This process, embodied by Lincoln and Carey, was once known far and wide as the American system, and it isn't a coincidence that every single American president who died while in office, that would be 8 in total, were supporters of this system. The origins of the American system. During the period of 1783 to 1791, the newly established American Republic was an agrarian economy in financial ruin, with no means to pay its debts or even to pay the soldiers who had fought for years in the Revolutionary War. It was only a matter of time before the fragile new nation would come undone and be reabsorbed back into the fold of the British Empire. The solution to this unsolvable crisis was unveiled by Washington's former aide-de-camp and now Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, who studied the works of the great dirigiste economists like France's finance minister Jean-Baptiste Colbert, and introduced a fourfold solution. First, consolidate all unpayable state debts into a singular federal debt secured by the issuance of new bonds. This was done via his 1790 Report on Public Credit. Second, tie these new bonds to internal improvements like roads, canals, academies, and industrial growth, which would create a qualitatively new form of debt that would permit the nation to produce its way out of poverty, which in turn would lead to the augmentation of the active or productive capital of a country. In this sense, Hamilton distinguished bad debt from good debt, using the important guiding principle that the creation of debt should always be accompanied with the means of its extinguishment. To illustrate this more clearly, think of a farmer taking on debt in order to feed a gambling addiction versus investing his loan into new farm supplies and a tractor. The thrust of this conception was found in Hamilton's Report on the Subject of Manufactures of 1791. Third, guide that new national power over finance by a system of national banks subservient to the Constitution and to the general welfare, instead of a system of central banks under the British model that ensured nation-states would forever be subservient to the laws of usurious finance. This was illustrated in Hamilton's 1790 Report on a National Bank and in his 1791 On the Constitutionality of a National Bank. Fourth, use protective measures where necessary to block foreign dumping of cheap goods into the nation from abroad, essentially making it more profitable to purchase industrial goods and farm products locally rather than from abroad. Hamilton also promoted federal incentives and bounties to encourage private enterprise to build things that would be in alignment with national interests. Hamilton's idea for the National Bank was premised on the unification of private profit with the well-being of the whole nation in order to overcome the dichotomy of state versus individual rights, which has plagued so much of philosophy and human history. Describing the importance of a national bank, Hamilton wrote, "A nation that has no mines of its own must derive the precious metals from others, generally speaking, in exchange for the products of its labor and industry. The quantity it will possess will therefore, in the ordinary course of things, be regulated by the favorable or unfavorable balance of its trade, that is, by the proportion between its abilities to supply foreigners and its wants of them, between the amount of its exportations and that of its importations. Hence, the state of its agriculture and manufactures, the quantity and quality of its labor and industry must, in the main, influence and determine the increase or decrease of its gold and silver. The support of industry is probably in every case of more consequence towards correcting a wrong balance of trade than any practicable retrenchments in the expenses of families or individuals, and the stagnation of it would be likely to have more effect in prolonging than any such savings in shortening its continuance. That stagnation is a natural consequence of an inadequate medium, which, without the aid of bank circulation, would, in the cases supposed, be severely felt." In opposition to the Jeffersonian crowd promoting British free trade and attacking the idea of manufacturers and a strong federal government, Hamilton wrote that there is a general principle inherent in the very definition of government and essential to every step of the progress to be made by that of the United States, namely, that every power vested in a government is in its nature sovereign and includes, by force of the term, a right to employ all the means requisite and fairly applicable to the attainment of the ends of such power, and which are not precluded by restrictions and exceptions specified in the Constitution, or not immoral, or not contrary to the essential ends of political society. Hamilton added that this must exist to give encouragement to the enterprise of our own merchants and to advance our navigation and manufactures. Throughout all of his works, Hamilton is clear that value is not located in land, gold, money, or any arbitrary value favored by followers of the British school like Adam Smith. In defending the growth of manufactures and internal improvements, Hamilton states in his report on manufacturing that, "To cherish and stimulate the activity of the human mind by multiplying the objects of enterprise is not among the least considerable of the expedients by which the wealth of a nation may be promoted." The overthrow of the American system. Although City of London-affiliated traitors in America, like Aaron Burr, established the Speculative Bank of Manhattan, which started Wall Street, killed Alexander Hamilton in 1804, and derailed many of Hamilton's grand designs for the young republic, the system was never completely destroyed, despite the decades of attempts to do so. In 1824, the great German economist Friedrich Liszt came to America with the last surviving leader of the 1776 revolution, the Marquis de Lafayette, as part of an international effort to revive the sabotage plans to create a world of sovereign republics modeled on the American experience of 1776. While this effort failed with Lafayette's accession to the scheme of reinstating a French king in 1830 rather than declare himself the president, Liszt studied Hamilton's system and was the first to codify it as the American system of political economy. In the foreword to that book, Liszt outlines the importance of Hamilton's system of value premised upon increasing the productive powers of labor in opposition to the system of Adam Smith. "I previously knew the importance of means of transportation only from the standpoint taught by the theory of values, I had only observed the effect of transport business in particular instances, and only with respect to the expansion of the market and the reduction of prices for material goods. Only now did I begin to consider it from the point of view of the theory of productive forces and in its total effect as a national transportation system, consequently, according to its influence upon the entire mental and political life, social intercourse, the productivity and the power of nations. Only now did I recognize the reciprocal relationship which exists between manufacturing power and the national system of transportation, and that the one can never develop to its fullest without the other. Thus was I able to study this material, this I dare to claim, more comprehensively than any other economist before me had done, and to cast a clear light upon the necessity and the utility of entire national systems of railroads. And I did this before any economist in England, France, or North America had thought of considering these matters from this higher standpoint. This was the system that Liszt transported to Germany by driving rail development, industrial growth, and protectionism under the German Zollverein, which finally blossomed under the rule of Chancellor Otto von Bismarck. Liszt's system was also studied, translated, and applied in Russia by many American system economists, with the greatest being the Transport Minister and Prime Minister Sergei Vita, who oversaw the Trans-Siberian Railway's completion and envisioned a line eventually connecting the Americas to Russia via the Bering Straits. In America, the clash between the American and British systems defined all major conflicts from 1836 onward, when Andrew Jackson killed the Second National Bank, along with thousands of Cherokees, and brought the nation under the heel of British free trade, speculation, and cotton plantation economics. Following the IMF's protocols they imposed onto victims' nations 150 years later, Jackson canceled all internal improvements in order to pay the debt and deregulated the banking system, which resulted in the growth of over 7,000 separate currencies issued by an array of state banks, rendering the economy chaotic, bankrupt, and prone to mass counterfeiting. The defenders of the American system during this period, led by Whigs such as John Quincy Adams, Abraham Lincoln, and Henry Clay, played a rearguard action, hoping for an opening to occur at some point. When that opening finally arrived with the victory of Whig President William Harrison in 1840, a glimmer of hope was felt. Harrison swept to power with a mandate to revive the National Bank and enact Clay's American system of internal improvements. Sadly, President Harrison found himself dead only 3 months after his election, with legislation for the Third National Bank sitting unsigned on his desk. Over his dead body, and that of another Whig president only 10 years later, the slave power grew in influence enormously. It wasn't until 1861 that a new president arose who successfully avoided assassination attempts long enough to revive Hamilton's American system during a period of existential crisis, of economic bankruptcy, and foreign-sponsored civil war, which nearly destroyed the Union in ways not that dissimilar to the situation unfolding in America today.